You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 19th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder. We'll be back next week. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, environmental historian Troy Batatis. Environmental engineer Drew Pendergrass, authors of Half Earth Socialism, A Plan to Save the Future from Extinction, Climate Change, and Pandemics. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Florida has overturned the mask mandate on planes and other public transit. She was appointed by, guess who, Donald Trump? More on that in a bit. Regrouped Russian forces have begun their offensive in eastern Donbass, in the eastern Donbass region, however, although military strikes continue throughout other parts of Ukraine. Pro-Russian Ukrainian separatists have been fighting in the Donbass for 8 years, and now Russian troops will likely be directly involved. After its weekend assaults on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Israel has begun air raids in the Gaza Strip, ostensibly in retaliation for the terrorist attacks within Israel in the weeks prior. However, this is a consistent pattern during Ramadan. And never forget, this is in the context of an occupation and one actor has all the power. Ron DeSantis has decided to ban dozens of proposed math textbooks because they had language about being kind to others in them. Seriously. And in union news, Apple employees at the Grand Central terminal location here in New York City have signed union cards. They are calling themselves the Fruit Stand Workers United, and they could be the first union in the history of Apple. Solidarity with them. And lastly, Mayor Eric Adams is reportedly considering putting metal detectors in the entrances of subway stations.
Oh, nice. It's raised fares to pay for that.
Not cumbersome at all. And it wouldn't target specific people, I'm sure, and it wouldn't make mistakes, not allow people to get on trains in time. Let's make the subway system more inefficient. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is Tuesday, Newsday Tuesday normally, but we do have a guest this week because Sam is out. So how this is working is, I know some people have been asking, Sam had got COVID last week. He's thankfully doing better. It's all around New York right now. Bradley, hope I'm not outing you. He had a close contact, so it's just myself and where are you? Yes, there you go. It just does not sound as good without the mic.
Yeah, actually, and the studio audience won't be able to hear Bradley because he's not coming through OBS.
Okay, well, yeah. Stop talking because they can't hear you. So, but, yes, only text us.
But yeah, Bradley, you can't be a disembodied voice and talk to only us. So that's a good skill you have.
Right, you'll be the voice in our heads. So, yeah, but Bradley's out. So it's just myself and Matt today. But, yes, Sam's out. He had his kids have spring break this week. Last week was when he had COVID. So I think this must be the longest he's not done a show, or at least even a pre-recorded show.
It is absolutely in my... I started in fall 2015. There's not been two straight weeks where Sam hasn't at least put out a pre-recorded broadcast. So definitely the longest stretch.
I can't even imagine what's going on in his brain right now in terms of that. But a reminder, too. I want to remind you all of that schedule. And also, we are fast approaching, less than a month away from the Boston show. May 15th at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. Check it out. You can go to majority.fm to find tickets. There's only a few left. We mostly have them sold out at this point. So check it out. Boston show, The Big Live. And now let's get into this this decision by the federal judge in Florida. So yesterday, a federal judge in Florida struck down the federal mask mandate on public transit travel. So not just public transit, but large scale transit like airplanes, buses, trains, etc. This was just a few days after the CDC had extended that same mask mandate through May 3rd. As we've been seeing an increase of COVID cases in many pockets of the country, the Northeast, New York City being one of those pockets. The decision said that individual airlines will get to make this decision. Companies can decide what they want to do. The judge is problematic, and we'll get to her in a minute. But here is some footage compiled by the Wall Street Journal of the jubilant passengers removing their masks, sometimes in the middle of a flight, when they got this news via workers on the airplane, etc.
Couldn't help but notice a few people still wearing their masks in that.
Oh, video. Yeah. There's a few Twitter threads of people who were in the middle of that getting announced, like, I am doubling down on this K95, etc. But continue.
If you choose to, you may remove your mask.
Can you put, yeah, that's not how it works. Your mask does, it does help protect you, especially if it's an N95, KN95, etc. But the masking of other people is what is going to also help protect you. That is primarily the purpose of masking on public transport.
I mean, truly one of the stupidest things I've seen in my lifetime is all the people that pretended like this was like facing Orwellian style or Brave New World style tyranny.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is like what it looks like for that Berlin Wall to fall is the pilot saying, yeah, you can take your mask down. If you're immunocompromised, just, you know, stay masked up. Good for you. Good luck. Like,
it's a historic moment, Matt. I don't know why you're downplaying it.
It's really like Juneteenth all over again.
Oh, jeez. Get going.
The CDC continues recommending wearing a mask in public transit.
So, I mean, you couldn't read all the text there, but essentially that was Jen Psaki responding to it. They are disappointed in the decision, they say, and they're going to be looking into whether or not the DOJ might appeal. But I'm not so sure they will, because that Wall Street Journal, if you're listening on the podcast, kind of video that had some captions in it was mentioning how airline industry groups have been lobbying for this for quite a while. And that is the case. As soon as this decision was handed down, all of the airlines were like, yes, optional. We want to attract as many customers as possible. I mean, I would be very fearful for their employees who have to interact with a bunch of people, hundreds of people, sometimes on a daily basis on separate flights, especially if you're a flight attendant. But, you know, I mean, more power to the executives who are happy to put their employees in harm's way, even though we did see in some of those videos, some employees I'm sure are going to be happy about this because it's cumbersome, fine, understandable. It's a difficult part of one's profession.
It sucks to wear a mask, but it's not dying.
It's not dying, right. It is for public good. But now on to this this judge who made the decision, because I think this is important. Here's from Rolling Stone. Trump-appointed judge deemed, quote, not qualified by Bar Association voids mask mandate on planes and other travel. This woman is really just skyrocketed to the top. A Trump-appointed federal judge in Florida has voided a national mask mandate for airplanes and other transportation. Wearing a mask cleans nothing, U.S. District Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell wrote in her decision on Monday. At most, it traps virus droplets, but it neither sanitizes the person wearing the mask nor sanitizes the conveyance. Right, I'm not saying that.
Conveyance.
Right. Conveyance. That is not the standard. I did not realize there was some sort of judicial standard on total and complete sanitization in order to meet some sort of public health criteria. No, it is one method that helps protect people who are traveling on airplanes and other transportation. It helps other people when everyone has to comply, and it helps oneself you are wearing a mask.
It's a mitigation measure, albeit a meager one, which means we should be doing a whole lot else on top of it.
Yeah.
But it is one that, it's valuable.
They treat it as a zero-sum game, and it's like this straw man that is in order to just discredit public health officials, and just because they feel mildly uncomfortable in masks. Mizell, 35, was only 8 years out of law school at the University of Florida when Trump appointed her to a lifetime position in 2020. The Daily Beast noted at the time that her only trial experience was as an intern, and that she held 4 clerkships, including one for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Mizell was rated, quote, not qualified by the American Bar Association prior to her appointment, citing her lack of experience. So, I mean, just another case of the Trump administration not giving an F and stacking these courts with complete political activists. And it's smart for their purposes, because I don't think the Biden administration is going to have the gumption to have the DOJ try to appeal this. They see COVID as a political liability. That's why at the State of the Union, no one was wearing a mask. That's why Biden was leading applause lines about COVID being over. This is something they perceive as a political liability, so they are going to sacrifice public health. And let's be clear, it's the conservatives and the Republicans who are leading the charge here.
Yeah.
But the Biden administration is going to be too cowardly, this is my guess, to actually do anything aggressively about this.
So all the people were saying, you're just fear-mongering about COVID. You're getting what you want. Good job.
The Senate voted last month to overturn the public health order requiring masks on airplanes and public transit. And as the Post points out, 21 states, most of which are led by Republicans, sued the government seeking to end the mask mandate. CEOs from airline companies have also urged Biden to lift the mandate. Maybe these airlines can start to hire people back and use the government bailout money that they received, so that the customer experience is like actually a usable one that functions in society, regardless of the masking, right? Where flights aren't being canceled all over because these companies are too greedy to actually hire people back to fill the new traffic that is coming through as people begin to travel more.
Yeah. And the thing about like letting this decision go up to the airlines, the problem with that is the problem you had in when states took this this tack with restaurants. Any restaurant can decide if they want to do masks or not. Then, like, the problem is you have to enforce that, and then it's on the restaurants individually to enforce that. So you put in more of those workers, even more on the front line of somebody saying, "Hey, Bennigan's didn't require me to wear a mask. Why is TGI Fridays? And I'm going to get in your face about it."
Yep.
So, like, good luck to thinking that this is going to lead to a better customer experience. It's going to lead to more infections, and hopefully that some of the airlines continue to enforce it.
They're not. Basically, none of them did. To your point, in response, they all it was all a race to be the most anti-mask, because they perceive it as a way that, something cumbersome on the customer, and that they want to drive up their profits more, and that people don't want to fly because of it.
Yeah, if you're at risk, don't fly. We'll make it up with the people that don't care about you.
With that said, we have some advertisements today. Did you know that 1 out of 3 Americans report being sleep deprived, and their sheets could be the problem? Luckily, Cozy Earth provides the softest, most luxurious and best temperature regulating sheets. Cozy Earth has been featured on Oprah's Most Favorite Things list 4 years in a row. I mean, come on. That means it's the good stuff. Made from super soft viscose from bamboo. Cozy Earth sheets breathe so you sleep at the perfect temperature all year round. And with thousands of five-star reviews, it's no wonder that Cozy Earth sheets have become the bedding of choice for interior designers and celebrities. Now, I just ordered my Cozy Earth sheet, not sheet, comforter. There's a comforter and it's like a duvet that comes on top of it. And I have not put it together yet because it just arrived, but I have felt it and I can attest to this. Cozy Earth even offers a 100-night sleep trial, which means you have up to 100 nights to sleep on it, wash it, try it out. If you're not completely in love, just send it back for a full refund. There's a 10-year warranty, and Cozy Earth sheets come in 4 new colors. And for a limited time, save 35% on Cozy Earth bedding. That is a huge discount. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority and enter my special promo code MAJORITY at checkout to save 35% now. That's what I use to get my new comforter, Majority. That's CozyEarth.com/majority, and be sure to enter Majority at checkout for 35% off. And lastly, it is still happening, folks. 420 is tomorrow. And so, this 420 sale with Sunset Lake Sebede and the Majority Report in partnership with the Innocence Project, it's still going on. It ends, though, on April 24th at 11:59 p.m., just before midnight. 40% off smokables like hemp flower, pre-rolls, and keef, and 30% off everything else. There's no promo code needed. The products are already discounted on the website. Sunset Lake Sebede and the Majority Report are teaming up to turn everyone's favorite stoner holiday into a fundraising opportunity for the Innocence Project, a great organization working to undo the damage of the war on drugs. Here's how it works. Visit sunsetlakesebede.com starting Wednesday, April 13th. It's already started. Sunset Lake Sebede will be offering 40% off smokables like hemp flower, pre-rolls, and keef, and every other product will be 30% off, even my beloved tincture, which I used last night to get to sleep. Sunset Lake Sebede will be donating 4.20% of sales to the Innocence Project, a nonprofit organization that works to free the innocent, prevent wrongful convictions, and create fair, compassionate, and equitable systems of justice for everyone. Sunset Lake Sebede is a majority employee-owned business that donated more than $26,000 last year to anti-drug war organizations, animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. Again, visit Sunset Lake CBD. Maybe it works if I space it out. .com to take advantage of the discounts and help Majority Report raise money for a great organization. Sale ends April 24th. Make sure you check it out. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to be joined by Troy Vitez and Drew Pendergrass. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined now by environmental historian Troy Vitese and environmental engineer Drew Pendergrass, authors of Half-Earth Socialism, A Plan to Save the Future from Extinction, Climate Change, and Pandemics. Thank you so much for both for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. So the concept of half-earth socialism, just give us a sense of what you mean by that.
I'll start. So half-earth socialism is basically two projects in one, and one is to really think through what socialism is. And we make an argument, because I think a lot of left-wingers can't really give you a straight answer, or maybe they will harken back to a Keynesian kind of post-war welfare state, and or maybe some kind of anarchist utopia where there's no state and people can do whatever they want, or who knows what, right? Or maybe some kind of cybernetic future of like where computers will figure everything out. So we were dissatisfied with that approach, and then we tried to think through using an engagement with economic theory, with planning theory, with ecology, and new climate sciences to think through ways to build a socialist society and then create mechanisms to have an economy without markets. And so that's, you know, and there are many ways to do that. People can decide different levels of energy production, how they produce their energy, how they produce their food, and kinds of transportation. But we should decide collectively how we will live, basically. So that's one part. The second part, and why we call it half-earth socialism, is that, you know, when we approached those questions, we came up with what we thought would be the best solution, and that would basically be giving people a somewhat modest but still, I know, decent living standard, lower than is maybe normal in the global north, but much higher for most places in the global south. It would also incorporate veganism. It would incorporate public transportation. It would incorporate rewilding on a massive scale. So that means increasing the amount of nature preserves from around 10 or 15% to around half of all land, and to have a transition to renewable energy. So these are the components that we see to be extremely important to solve not just the climate crisis, but also the problem of pandemics and extinction. And we argue that these different problems have to be thought together, and socialism is the best way to achieve that.
Right. And so that's when you say half that earth is protected, that's where you get, you know, half earth socialism, that concept, right? Where the idea is half the earth is walled off, protected for habitats for non-humans. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I think we would say that. So there is a sort of in the conservationist movement, a half earth sort of movement that does maybe push from that more, you know, strict distinction, strict non-human nature preserves. We point out in the book that biodiversity is often higher on indigenous lands than in nature preserves. So we don't need to follow that exact conservationist line. You know, half-earth socialism would involve indigenous sovereignty, for example. But the point there is that to protect against the ongoing sixth mass extinction in Earth's history, where we're losing species at a very high rate. And we should care about that, not just because we should care about the other things on this planet, but because it impacts us. You know, this planet keeps us alive. It keeps everything going. So we should care about that. And that's driven by ecosystem loss. So we should take seriously this need to have stable ecosystems. And that involves, you know, ecosystems functioning healthy in a healthy way. And so there are many ways to achieve that. It doesn't need to be one picture, but it does need to be functioning and healthy.
No, I was overly simple because, I mean, you critique or expand on the concept from E.O. Wilson, who at least in the beginning part of your book, whereas I guess it's a bit of a starting off point, but the you kind of yes and that concept. Do you mind talking about it from its origin versus how you expanded upon it?
Sure. So E.O. Wilson works with other ecologists in the 1960s, and they find a relationship between land area and biodiversity. They were actually studying islands at that point in time, so larger islands have more biodiversity. And it you actually can work out a pretty mathematical relationship to figure out that how much biodiversity you would expect in this in a certain land area. So what they discovered a few decades later was that nature preserves as we have them now act as islands surrounded by, you know, fields for agricultural produce or pastures of cities, of mines or whatever it is. But they, because we have taken so much of nature, these nature preserves are separate from each other and other wild areas. And therefore, if we only protect around 10 or 15% of the world, then we can expect quite severe biodiversity loss in the rest of the world, and that would be around 50%. So that's what they expect based on this relationship of land area to biodiversity. So if you want to prevent that loss, you would actually increase the amount of protected areas, and that would, to us, they propose 50%, which would preserve around 85% of species. So we still would lose 15% of species, which is not great, but it's not nearly as bad as previous mega extinctions. And there have been other conservationists who have worked on this problem, and we get into the intellectual history of this idea. So Wilson is important, but we also have these South African conservationists, you know, led by Ian Player. And then there's also an American group called the Wildlands Network, led by Dave Foreman, and they don't have very good politics. So Wilson is, I mean, that puts it very mildly. I mean, they're very Malthusian, they're racist, colonialist, they work with Rhodesian mercenaries, they like the apartheid, you know, government, you know, they want to keep out, you know, Mexican immigrants, you know, all this really awful stuff. And then E.O. Wilson, who definitely has been criticized a lot for his views on sociobiology. He has also worked with some, you know, race scientists that was we've discovered recently with some investigative journalism. So he's definitely not a perfect figure, and we don't, we're not trying to whitewash any of that. Indeed, our book tries to really criticize the environmental movement and say that, you know, conservation is really important, but we have to deal with this colonial past so we can make a broader coalition. And then the last thing I'll say is the conservation movement we have now, you know, it maybe isn't as wicked as it was before, but they still depend on philanthropists. They depend on people like Ted Turner and other billionaires to give lots of money and buy up a lot of land. And this is not a good solution either. So we're saying socialists should care about conservation, but it needs to be a socialist conservation.
Right. And so can you do you mind expanding a little bit historically on the conservation movement as a whole? And I think you laid out well where it needs updating and an embedding of socialist ideology. But beforehand, where were the emphases wrong in particular?
I'll be brief, and then I'm sure Drew wants to jump in. So, you know, we go back quite a ways in the book. We go back to the 18th century to think about different approaches to environmental thought. And we say there's a Hegelian approach, and that is part of the Marxist tradition as well. And that means we see history as a story of people dominating nature, what Hegel calls humanizing nature. And that means we work in the environment and we transform it and we instill it with human consciousness. And the end of history will be a utopia where all of nature has been humanized. Like everything is a canal or a field or a garden and so forth, right? And that's one tradition. And that has many problems, which, you know, maybe we can get into. And the other would be also from the late 18th century is Malthus's attack on utopianism at that time. And he says basically that humans will always have too many children if there's any kind of prosperity that will lower living standards. And it only can be, you know, what he calls positive checks of epidemics or starvation or war that will then lower population. So utopia is impossible. And then Malthusian views have become extremely important for the environmental movement in the 60s and 70s, where they see most environmental problems as caused by having too many people, and therefore they have to control population. And that's really
the problem. Well, that's very dangerous, right?
I mean,
you see the right in modern times adopting that to a degree as well. I would say that the the more forward-thinking fascist types. Tucker Carlson has been flirting with the concept of overpopulation. That's where some of those roads lead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've had eco-fascist mass shooters that would say that there's too many poor brown people and white people need to control other populations through genocide. And again, these environmentalists in like the 60s and 70s, they were quite open in saying, like, we need to stop food aid, we need to let people starve to death. And these are like the cuddly, you know, environmentalists that people like, such as, you know, like Paul Ehrlich, or you know, even like the Limits to Growth project and all that. And then there's worse people, of course, like Garrett Hardin, who comes up with the tragedy of the commons, which is a very, you know, widely known concept. He was directly tied to the white nationalist movement in the United States. So there's definitely a really ugly history, for sure, that leads up to the present. And our point is, when we write this book, is to say that environmentalists and conservationists really have to give up Malthus, right? And that's important too, because the problem that we are facing with the environmental crisis isn't caused by overpopulation. That's not a major part of the problem, right? The cause of the crisis is capitalism. And then also, if you aren't Malthusian and you're not racist or you're not colonialist, then you can make better coalitions to achieve your goals.
Right. Drew, did you want to jump in?
Well, I'll just add real quick that there is a reason that the person that Marx hated more than anyone, pretty much, was Malthus. Like, Marx calls him a plagiarizer, which is Marx's worst insult that he can offer in his writing, which is sort of hilarious. Because Malthus is writing against projects of liberation through this angle. So it's really important to remove that.
And in terms of, Drew, I want to ask you a bit about this before we move on from some of the concepts that you brought up there. Biodiversity loss and a mass extinction, what we're experiencing right now, no one is talking about this. What does that look like in what we're going through right now, and what does that loss mean?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I think briefly earlier, this is the sixth mass extinction in Earth's history. So it's especially strange mass extinction because we're going through a mass extinction of insects. That's only happened once before in Earth's 4 billion year history. We talk a lot about the consequences of this. I think, you know, some things that people hear about are a little bit like pollinator loss. So pollinators, you know, keep our food coming. So that's really bad. You know, healthy ecosystems sequester more carbon. We talk about this in the book a good bit, about how, you know, if you have, you know, beavers and apex predators and all these things, that creates these healthy ecosystems that are able to really function better in the carbon system. We talk about the biological pump in the ocean where, you know, creatures all live in the ocean. They die and they sink to the bottom, taking carbon with them. So there's this sort of carbon cycle aspect of biodiversity too. It's a real tragedy that we're living in this mass extinction, and it's something that we should consider on the scale of climate change as a crisis to be confronted and to overcome.
If I could add a little bit, yeah. So, I mean, it's funny that people like saying, you know, the Anthropocene all the time. That's a very trendy concept, especially amongst, you know, environmentalists in the academy. But what's strange about it is, like, the real marker for the Anthropocene would be the fossil record, right? And we'll suddenly see all these species disappearing. But people don't focus about biodiversity. If you talk to, you know, ecologists and environmental scientists, they'll tell you that the sixth extinction is as serious as climate change. And perhaps even more serious, but yeah, no one's really talking about it because people don't really care about animals at some level, and I think that's a huge problem. And in this book, we're saying the left needs to care about animals. And I would also say that in some ways, it's like an unsexy topic because the main people want to say, well, no, climate change is causing extinction. It definitely is, but the main driver is still land use change, and the main cause of land use change is animal husbandry. So when people eat more meat, it's going to cause more extinctions, but people don't want to politicize what we eat, and that's a huge part of this problem.
Right. So how in terms of Well, one, I want to just touch on the land use point, because the capitalist solutions to climate change don't really reckon with this. Can you expand on that a bit? In fact, they exacerbate it. Some of the solutions that seem sexy to environmental advocacy groups, or even if there's like, you know, these big conferences where they're talking about solutions, the usage of land is inherent in those proposals. And if you don't mind, touching on why that falls short.
Yeah, I think one really interesting thing that people don't really know about. So people hear about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports every once in a while when they come out. And, you know, this is where lines like we have 12 years to stop climate change come in, which I don't love that framing. But the way these reports work is that a bunch of people around the world run climate models under various sort of social and economic scenarios that are proposed, that are kind of, you run an economy model, like you run a capitalist economy with a climate model attached, and you see what happens in the future under different assumptions. And a lot of these models that get low amounts of global warming, 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average, have a lot of carbon dioxide removal in the model. And the main way that they do carbon dioxide removal in the model is something called bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. The idea is that you have massive plantations of trees. The trees absorb carbon as they grow. You cut down the trees and you burn them for electricity. And then you capture the carbon emitted by the trees. You liquefy it and then you bury it deep underground, like reverse oil mining, basically. And a lot of the IPCC models that get to those low amounts of warming have BECCS plantations that are about the size of India, you know, two Indias worth of land. So this question of land comes up there, and it's very little discussed, probably because it's not going to happen. Like the it's very expensive. It'll cause a lot of biodiversity issues. It's not really a serious proposal, but it does come up in these models. And then there's the meat question that Troy was talking about, which is that, you know, something like half of our arable land goes to agriculture, and most of that goes to animal agriculture, which doesn't provide a lot of calories, but it does take up a huge amount of land. It leads to monocrops of soybean and corn so that we can feed those animals. It leads to pandemics, right? Because pandemics can develop among these animals. It's a very irrational way of getting food, leaving aside ethical questions, because like animals are designed to like walk around and do things, not to produce muscle for us to eat. So it's not rational way of producing food. And that leads to this land inefficiency. And all these things compete with things like biodiversity, but also things like land use change has led to something like a third of historical emissions. And you can presumably reverse some of that by allowing those ecosystems to return to some more healthy functioning state. So these land questions just keep emerging.
Well, if I could just jump in real quick, I'd say you're asking what are the solutions that are being proposed, right? And I think BECCS, wait again, this bioenergy and carbon capture and storage, you know, that's important for, I think, climate scientists, but really no other political group. Like no one else is really talking about it. And they like it because it makes their models work, right? As you say. Then you have, I think, mainstream environmentalists, people like James Hansen, who's, you know, well known for being, you know, a scientist at NASA and raising the alarm about climate change, you know, 30 years ago and so forth. And he's really into nuclear power and especially a really untested kind of nuclear technology called fast breeders, right? And then which, you know, nuclear power doesn't work very well, and this will not happen.
Well, I would love to ask you next to expand on nuclear power, if you don't mind, but keep going.
Sure. And then there's the neoliberal solution, which basically is have scientists, entrepreneurs come up with their own solutions, which probably will be some form of geoengineering where you have solar radiation management and block out radiation from the sun by putting sulfur aerosols up there with high-flying planes. And this is super cheap. This is being bankrolled by philanthropists like Bill Gates. There's a big center for it at Harvard University and many other places. It's supported by the Democrats and the Republicans, and neoliberal economists and think tanks have been supporting it for a long time. So that's, you know, of all these different solutions we're talking about, the idea of having large-scale conservation and veganism is not going to happen under capitalism because it's just too unprofitable. Like the idea of leaving half the world uncommodified is hard to, you know, impossible to imagine. And the mainstream environmentalists have these really pathetic solutions, such as you know cap and trade or these BECs or nuclear. And then the most likely scenario is the most reckless one, and that's geoengineering. So that we're saying the left needs to see the whole problem, right, of the environmental crisis, understand its causes, and then give solutions that, because otherwise there will be radical, dangerous changes to the biosphere, and we're just going to be bystanders.
Well, it's honestly, it's intersectionality, I guess, and also an understanding of environmental policy within socialism more broadly. I mean, that is the concept of your book. But in terms of nuclear power, do you mind talking a bit more about that? Because I've documented my fears about nuclear power on this show quite a bit. The concept of storage under a capitalist system of that kind of waste makes me very nervous, given what we see in oil spills throughout the country. What is your position on some areas of leftists who are pretty bullish on nuclear power being the only way to wean us off of fossil fuels?
I think that this is a really important conversation. So there is a proposal out there from people like James Hansen that Troy was mentioning, which is something like building a new nuclear reactor every week or something like this.
Every 3 days.
To try and really build up a lot of nuclear power. And the idea here is that nuclear is a way to, if you discount carbon emitted from uranium mining and refining and concrete and all that stuff, is a way to decarbonize the energy system, and it does have less carbon emissions. You can run the nuclear power station 24/7. It's based on a stock, so you mine it and use that energy rather than you gather a flow of energy from the sun or the wind, which is
right,
intermittent. So that's sort of the idea here, is that you'd have a grid there, and then you run it, and then you can avoid some of the issues of renewables. The problem with nuclear, there are a few problems. One is that it helps you decarbonize the electricity sector, but a lot of the challenge of the future is electrification. So I think there's this sort of, like, if we just build a bunch of nuclear reactors, climate change will be solved, but it only gets you a part, it's only ever going to be a partial solution from that angle. So there's this, like, kind of almost weird, like, cargo cult nature of, like, if we could just get people to stop being afraid of nuclear power, then climate change would be over. And that's not true. The other part is that nuclear power plants take a very long time to build historically, and they're very expensive, which is why there are these fast breeder reactors that Troy was mentioning, some new technology that's being proposed to help with nuclear power. But those technologies don't work very well because, for example, fast breeder reactors, which can use some of the nuclear waste to power themselves, rely on sodium as a coolant. Sodium explodes when exposed to air. It makes it hard to keep the power plant running. So that's sort of why it's had some problems recently. So it's just a technology that I don't think is able to deliver what people want. And then there's also the fears, right? They're real fears about nuclear dangers. It's not very popular, so it's not the sort of coalition building place. But maybe I'll let Troy go in on the nuclear bashing. I think it's important to just clarify real quick that what we're not saying is like shut down all the nuclear plants tomorrow. It's just skepticism at nuclear as like the band-aid for everything. Troy, what were you going
to
say?
Well, I would also say it's probably not a good idea to have 50-year-old nuclear reactors to run for much longer than they were built for, which is the situation we're in right now, which is not ideal. I agree with a lot of what Drew said, but I would also add that if you build, let's say, 10 times more reactors than we have now, we have around 400 reactors worldwide, you will use up uranium pretty fast, as in like the stocks that we have. And that means that you have to be going after more and more diluted ores, which will take up more energy. And therefore, the carbon intensity of nuclear is going to skyrocket. And so then you're then you basically you're wasting your time if it's not a carbon neutral energy supply.
Right.
I would stress one more thing, that the odds of a nuclear accident on the scale of Fukushima or Chernobyl are not negligible. I mean, it's estimated there's a 50% chance of it, something like that happening again over the next 30 years. And if you increase the number of reactors tenfold, then the odds are going to be a lot higher. So, and then as Drew's saying, the environmental movement, which is not a very strong movement, but the only thing they're really good at mobilizing, people to fight is nuclear power. And I mean, it emerged from as a pacifist anti-nuclear movement in the 60s. So to have mainstream environmentalists to say, oh yeah, we need nuclear power is like the best way to demobilize the environmental movement, exactly when we need to have broad coalitions and get people to really fight.
Right. And in terms of disasters resulting in things like, what we saw with Chernobyl, based on the technology that's available to us now, yes, things might have improved, but my perception is that the presentation of its likelihood when I read about it in mainstream articles is downplayed significantly.
I think
that's probably fair. Yeah, there's an article Troy cited here that maybe we can offer as a link later on. But I think it's a little downplayed.
Okay.
But there's like bad things that happen all the time, right? I mean, was it a few years ago they just discovered in France that they were setting the cement wrong and the concrete wrong, and then it was cracking all these pipes, and they had no idea until way too late. I mean, there's plenty of also small, again, I know people who work in the nuclear industry, and they say there's like small scale mishaps all the time, right? And people are getting irradiated all the time. And I think, and they keep this hush hush because, yeah, they want to keep popular support for it. They want to freak people out because a lot of these reactors are built very close to large cities. But the danger is real, and it's not going to go away. And I think if you're also going to be experimenting with new nuclear technologies like fast breeders or thorium reactors or fusion, I mean, to then say that's going to be safe, like either it's going to be safe or you're going to run out of uranium. I mean, you can't have it either way, right? And you can't even have that, so.
So in terms of the vision that you all have laid out, what are some practical ways that you think that everyday folks could contribute to this becoming more of a reality?
Right. So in the book, we kind of hinted at some of the things that we think would be a part of the solution to the environmental crisis. But the other angle of the book is that we want to start a debate where we all kind of are kind of imagining together full solutions to the environmental crisis. So we say this at the beginning of the book that like we don't, you may disagree with us on various aspects, but we would encourage you to educate yourself, learn about these issues, buy our book, obviously.
That's the first thing you should do. Yeah,
exactly. Think about how these things fit together and then kind of imagine a future. So we think that this opening up imagining is really important. It's why we produced a video game that comes with the book where you can play a planner for the future and you can try whatever technologies or social policies you want, things that we agree with, things that we disagree with. We try and simulate them based on the scientific literature. There's even a real climate model in the game that takes your decisions, calculates emissions, calculates the climate effects. And so you can see that. And that'll be out in a couple of weeks at our website. So that imaginative aspect of like kind of opening the future up, we think is really important. We think that joining movements is really, really important because participating in movements for change is a way to kind of transform yourself from, this individual subject that's created by neoliberalism, where we think of ourselves only, and become a part of a larger project, a larger change. And the more people that participate in those sorts of movements, the more people we can bring in, the more of a powerful base that we can build that actually can drive the changes we need. And then there are some personal things you can do, like we think that you should give up meat if you can. But obviously, anything that an individual does is not going to be is a drop in the bucket. So it's building these movements. It's opening up your imagination, learning, talking to each other, banding together.
Yeah, I mean, what we're we're saying, like, you know, neoliberalism sucks. The future is going to suck, right? We know that.
Yes.
It's going to be inequality, you know, climate disaster, more pandemics, you know, more neoliberalism or neoliberalism mixed with fascism, right? So, I mean, it's going to be, and the idea is that the left be, you know, if you're a liberal, if you're a environmentalist, if you're a socialist, it's really think clearly about what kind of society do you want to live in, right? What is necessary to create a society that has, it can provide a good life for everyone and it can overcome the environmental crisis? Because I think we're past the time when people can just like hand wave and say, you know, workers of the world unite, or a better future is what we need, and another world is possible. We need a concrete plans, right? And I think, first of all, educating yourself about the state of the economy and the environment is important, but also thinking through what we need, like think through land use problems, think through, you know, food problems, like do learn a bit of math, learn a bit of science. You know, Drew did an amazing thing for the book where he actually made a linear program where you can figure out what kind of future you imagine is possible or not. You can say, how much energy use do we have? Are we eating meat? How much land are we preserving? What's the extinction rate? How much carbon are we emitting? What's the temperature going to be like? You can figure that all that stuff out and then see whether it's possible or not. Because again, like the land problem is a huge problem and there's not enough land for everything, or there's also not enough space for all the carbon we have to emit in the atmosphere to do whatever we want. We have to be serious about the solutions that we're willing to fight for. And I think, you know, we're trying to push other leftists to think seriously about power and the society they want. But anyone can do that. Anyone can become a planner. Anyone can become a theorist, I think.
Well, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time today. Troy Vitese, sorry about that, environmental historian and environmental engineer Drew Pendergrass, authors of Half Earth Socialism, A Plan to Save the Future from Extinction, Climate Change, and Pandemics. Thank you both so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Of course. All right, folks, with that, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the first hour of the show. We are back. Before we head into the fun half, I wanted to touch on this. So Ron DeSantis, he's, as Matt has been saying, the darling of conservative media right now. And he's doing everything that he can to build up his resume on anti-woke, anti-gay, anti-black pieces of legislation that he's implementing in Florida, so that when he eventually runs for president, his portfolio of hatred is thick. He's also just getting credit for it in conservative media for doing these kinds of things. And now he is in the business of banning books. That's the free speech warriors on the right. In this instance, there were some math textbooks that contained inappropriate material, according to Ron DeSantis. And so here he is at a press conference explaining why these math textbooks, and I'll let you know what the material was in a second, were unfit for children to use.
You do have things like social and emotional learning and some of the other things that are more political in there. In our view on something like math, first, it doesn't meet the standards. But second, you know, math is about getting the right answer. And we want kids to learn to think so they get the right answer. It's not about how you feel about the problem or to introduce some of these other things. It's there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer. And we want all our students getting the right answers. And so most of the books that did not meet Florida standards for whatever reason happened to be in the early grades. As you get into the older grades, most of those books did meet the standards. But we're going to continue to focus the education on the actual strong academic performance of the students. We don't want things like math to have, you know, some of these other concepts introduced. It's not been proven to be effective. And quite frankly, it takes our eye off the ball.
What is the ball? Yeah, he can't really say it out loud, but it's to make sure that there's enough of a firewall for parents who are conservatives who don't want their children learning not to hate people. And Ron DeSantis is going to provide that for them. And also, it's a twofer. Then you also get to target teachers. And if they teach material that might contain social and emotional learning in a context that is math class, where it's got to be straightforward, facts over feelings in a math class, right? Hey, those teachers can be fired. It's a great way to undercut teachers' unions, too. But what is the social and emotional learning that was in these textbooks? Here's from the New York Times. Florida has rejected 42 of 132 math textbooks proposed for use in public school classrooms because they, quote, incorporate prohibited topics or unsolicited strategies, including social emotional learning and critical race theory, according to the state's Department of Education. So take it with a boulder of salt. The state, which announced its decision on Friday afternoon, did not share information on the specific content to which it was objecting, and several publishers told the New York Times they had not yet received documents detailing the state's critiques. At a Monday news conference, Mr. DeSantis highlighted the presence of, quote, social and emotional learning material in the rejected elementary school textbooks. And then they quote some of what you heard there. A review of sample content from one publisher whose elementary school textbooks appear to have been rejected, Big Learning Ideas, showed, and, you know, trigger warning, this is really scary stuff that should not be taught to elementary school kids.
Is it going to be that white people are fundamentally bad and can't do good things and should feel ashamed for all of history? Is
close.
That math books.
You get a half a point. Lessons intended to build self-awareness, self-management, responsible decision-making, and social awareness, which, you know, that sounds kind of like black people aren't terrible.
It sounds like communism.
Yes. And relationship skills. The framework of five skills is a popular one in schools across the country and was developed by CASEL, an education nonprofit. In one text, it's graphic stuff, cartoon animals help build one another's confidence in order to cross a wobbly bridge. In another, a cartoon dog movie star says she feels lonely and other animals offer to befriend her. We can't have that.
Like anything that to sort of activate children's imaginations when they're trying to learn math. Like, that would be horrible.
It would be. I mean, and also to, you know, not silo pieces of your education and understanding that your job, whenever you get it as a child, is not to only perceive topics as their surface level task, but to have a holistic view of things that also incorporates kindness, maybe helping someone cross a wobbly bridge. No. DeSantis's math classes, in those kinds of classes, you're not helping an old lady cross the street. You're pushing her in front of a bus.
I mean, that's the thing about this stuff is how little of sort of any smoke there is for them to be running around yelling fire. And like this, and so they need like something, right? They need, oh, now it's these math books. There's this sort of like fuzzy language in, because they don't have any actual grooming or critical race or people being shamed for being white or whatever the hell the CRT panic is. So now it's math books are too, they give you a participation medal for your feelings or something.
Right. It's also just the politicization of empathy, right? They want to make empathy seem scary. They want to make kindness be associated with weakness or controversy for kids. And if you do that, if you kind of try to stamp out empathy as early as possible, there'll be better warriors in the anti-woke culture war when they come of age. All right, folks, with that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. We're going to head into the fun half. We will be taking your calls. We will be reading your IMs, 646-257-3920. But first, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning tomorrow?
Yeah, well, tomorrow we got Elias Cepeda. We're going to be talking about a few things, squad-related, anti-squad-related, and UFC-related. But also go check out our Patreon episode with Lillian Chichurkia on how we do not owe capitalists for the fact that we have liberal rights like free speech, and we should not trust capitalism to spread those rights or protect them. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that.
All right, 646-257-3920. And also a reminder, please, live show tickets, May 15th. Going quick. Get them. All right, see you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Drew.
What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Me? You're safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
If it's me, hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.